Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is season 2, episode 10. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I'm going to talk to two colleagues from across the pond in Western Europe, Drs. Leanne Norman, who's at the Carnegie School of Sport at Leeds Beckett University in the UK, and Dr. Donna DeHaan, Faculty of Health, Nutrition, and Sport at The Hague University of Applied Sciences in the Netherlands. Welcome to Tucker Center Talks. Good morning.
Thank you for having us. Thanks, Nicole.
Yes, this is great. And with three different time zones, it's amazing we got ourselves coordinated. And I'm really excited to talk to you about the great work that you both are doing around girls and women in sport and to make a difference in changing the system. So Dr. Norman, why don't you give us a brief background of your research interests related to girls and women in sport?
Well, thanks, Nicole. Yeah, I work at the Carnegie School of Sport, as you said, at Leeds Beckett, and I'm the director of the Research Centre for Social Justice in Sport and Society. And my own work that I lead is around understanding gender equity in sports coaching and how that impacts women and how those personal experiences and stories connect to more of the organisational piece as well. So the work has evolved over the last few years to really shine a light more on the cultural aspects and the structural and the political within the organisation. And then how that trickles down to impact personal experiences.
Great. And I think it's interesting because a lot of my own work has gone that same trajectory, which is how you and I at least had intersected around our interests in women in sports coaching and going from more maybe an individual-based documenting experience of women coaches to looking at the structural and systemic aspects of how do we change the culture to be better for women, for all women.
Because the work at the start was very much, you know, platforming those personal stories and working with the coaches. And then we realized it was half the story that you can tool people up as much as you want and develop people as much as you want. But if you're sending them back into the same workplaces Monday morning, very little is going to change. And we know the power of culture, that it will just take over anyway in a few months. So that's really the joint focus now.
Absolutely. And Dr. DeHaan, I know your work dovetails very nicely, which is why we've been collaborating together. So tell us a little bit about what you focus on in your research.
Yeah, thanks, Nicole. I mean, I'm a qualitative researcher, so I'm passionate about understanding the lived experience. And just like Leanne said, the work has evolved to organizational change. I have a background in sociology and management, so I'm interested in the lived experience, but to make managerial changes to change the culture, so to facilitate sport to be a space where everybody can thrive and have a positive experience. And whilst gender is at the forefront of that, it's really about making sport safe and a space for everybody, not just one particular type of person.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about changing the system, this is the hardest work. It's easy to do coach development. Well, not easy, but it's easier to coach up the coaches, develop networks. But to change systems of homophobia and sexism and gender bias, this is the real hard work that we're all really trying to dig into and create change around. And I know that the two of you have been collaborating recently on some work with UEFA. Do you want to talk about that?
we were very lucky because we're the first project team to be funded by UEFA in the area of gender equity and sport and football governance. So that was awarded last summer, I believe, and we've just concluded it. But the main focus of that was football governance of the highest levels, so European football associations, and we had 7 football associations. And then within that, and we had some really diverse contexts, and that was purposeful as well. So we did have England and the Netherlands, of course, and then we had contexts that you don't hear much about, the Russian FA, Croatian FA, Slovenia. And within that, we spoke to 34 people that occupy heads of departments or they're on the executive committees. And really the question was around what role do men play in improving gender equity? Donna, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, thanks, Leanne. And I think the reason, and this is at the heart of what I'm passionate about as well, for too long, gender equality has been positioned as a woman's issue. We deliberately wanted to talk to men and women. We know that men hold decision-making positions in sports, very much dominant in football. We're not going to facilitate change unless the people in that make decisions want to make the change. So we wanted to talk to men and women about the role that men can play in facilitating gender equity. So take it out of a woman's issue and to look at it as an issue for football.
I think it's interesting because while we're, you know, thousands of miles apart doing very similar work in different contexts within the umbrella of sport, I too have arrived exactly at that same spot, is that if we do not engage the men and educate and create awareness and bring them in as allies for those who want to be allies, because many don't, nothing is going to change, absolutely nothing. And we're just talking into a vacuum. And so this idea of allyship is bringing men in. I've had this idea, and perhaps I've shared this with you in the past, is I really think there's a continuum of men, from those who are allies to those who want to be allies, but they're not really sure how, and they're sort of struggling with getting there, to wannabes. Like, they want to be an ally, but, and they talk, they give lip service. Yeah, yeah, gender equity, love it. You know, I support women, go women. But then in the bar, in the locker room, they're sort of, can you believe they're trying to give women all this access to our world? And then you've got hostile men, what I might call the good old boys, who are never going to change. And I'm wondering if either of you can reflect on this idea of perhaps how do we focus on the men who want to get there, and then stop wasting our time on the men who are never going to change their minds and unfortunately have many positions of power. I don't know. I just want your reaction on that. Donna, you want to go first?
Oh, this is such a good question, and I wish I had the answer off the top of my head. But I agree that there is a continuum of where everybody sits on this. There is a continuum of where women sit on this spectrum as well, and of men. And I think it is about identifying where people are on the continuum, but also helping them understand where they are. I think a lot of people don't know themselves, can't see the woods for the trees, and the type of research that we do, and then the interventions or the workshops or the dissemination helps with that light bulb moment for individuals as well, to understand where they are and why they have this. And it's not necessarily, I mean, in the research that we did, we worked with 7 countries, as Leanne said, and the place of gender within those countries, cultures, and society is very, very different. So people don't enter sport from a spaceship. You know, they bring with them their experiences from school, from work, from society. It's a lot of baggage that they bring with them. And it's about, I think, unpacking that as much as then looking at it in the context of sport.
Yeah, I mean, I was during that study, I was in an interview situations with all of those men on the continuum. I was going from one man that was telling me that you could feel it, you could see it in his face. This was very much, he was for this, and it wasn't just because it's a buzzword or because he felt that he had to say it being in a room with a woman. You could see it was part of, he was you might call progressive or just a normal chap, but he was very much about gender equity because he could see the case for it and he could link that to other issues in the sport. So he was talking about corruption in the game and he was talking about the hemorrhaging male players. So for him it was a good thing and it was a moral right thing to do, but also that it would help solve some of the issues they were experiencing in football anyway. But then I was in an interview situation with the guy that I thought, I called him the smiling assassin, because from one minute he was saying lovely things, but when we got into the bulk of the interview, then it all started to come out in terms of women's football is boring. They don't do anything but kick the ball out all the time. And I've tried taking my sons and it's just boring. And then he was saying, I won't appoint a woman because she will want a family. So that I ask her in that interview if she wants a family, then I make sure I don't appoint her because she'll muck up my plans, those sorts of things. So I've been in situations with all those people on that continuum, Nicole. And I think it is recognizing who those men are that could be allies and putting them in positions where they can influence that change. And having the critical mass of those men and having them not just in leadership positions, but middle management roles as well. There's research from other sectors where people talk a lot about inclusive leadership and having male allies in leadership roles. But it's equally important to have men that are allies in middle management roles. So for example, your heads of coaching, your technical directors, as well as the president, to influence that change and hopefully right. minoritize those men that it will never change and won't ever get it.
Donna, do you have any follow-up to that?
I think just picking up on one of the things that Leanne said about the smiling assassin and his reaction to women can't play football. And I think what really struck us as well was the fact that we didn't ask any questions about women's football. Mm-hmm. We were asking about women in football. And I've done this same kind of study with other sports, and this was the first time that it has hit in this such a strong way that they were unable to separate women in football from women's football. And that was such a hard-hitting thing to kind of realize, that they don't see women as being an employee who can work in football. We, you know, and that has such a knock-on effect then for the places and spaces that women, you know, can move into. And we see this with the coaching. But it was such a hard-hitting, and maybe it was an obvious thing, and maybe I was being naive, not being prepared to feel it in that way going into it. But it was such a barrier that they were unable to separate as individuals, women as individuals that have the, you know, financial knowledge or marketing knowledge or HR expertise to work in a business, that they don't see that. It's all about football being a space for men.
That's so interesting. It reminds me of when we talk about consumers of women's sport, that the fans of women's sport and female athletes often get conflated as well, that, you know, if women's sport are going to succeed, then we need women to be fans. You know, it's sort of this... Yes. All women are lumped together in every single role and capacity, and some people just cannot tease that apart.
You have that with coaching, though, don't you? You have this. Of course, we want women coaches because we want them to be role models for female athletes, and of course they are. But that's not the only purpose, and it doesn't mean that they only coach women. So you do, like Donna was saying, we had that conflation. I would be saying, what about women in your organization? Well, we really believe in women's football, and I then brought the conversation back to the boardroom, and it was like, yeah, well, we're going to have a woman actually from this date, She's from women's football, so she'll tell us more about women's football. So you've got that dangerous rhetoric of women for women.
Right. And so in the work that you've been doing with UEFA and your other work that's complementary to this, including this study that we've done together, interviewing high-level, high-performance soccer/football coaches. How do we actually get to men to enlist them and bring them into allyship? I mean, is there a golden egg here that we can look to that provides us some hope?
I think it's having men that are influential, visible men that are talking this language. We've got a really great example here in the UK. It's Chris Ramsey, and he's head of the academy at one of the London male professional football clubs. And he's what you would call a male ally. And he's very clear and very open about that. You know, I remember being in a talk with him and him saying that if two coaches came to him for a job, one was a man, one was a woman, they both had identical CVs, he would always appoint the woman because he recognises the journey that she's come on is going to be much tougher. And he's got people like Manisha Taylor in those roles that he's appointed. And I've been in a talk when he's speaking like that, and you could see the men in the room, their heads turned, because it was not me standing up saying, we need male allies, and this is what, it was someone of influence. He's a high profile manager over here in England. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about it. And suddenly the mood changed in the room for the men. It was like, oh, okay, it's not just a feminist issue or those women going on again. It's actually, it makes sense. And it was just so matter of fact. And that's what we need. We need those high profile people speaking out like that.
Absolutely. Donna, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I think, I agree with Leanne. I agree with allies. And it does feel different when the conversation comes from a man as opposed to from a woman. And I think it's about, it comes further back to education. I mean, we're lecturers, we work in education. I work on a program of international students. I have 70 students in my first year cohort from around the world, and I'll teach a sociology class with them. And I am shocked. I mean, it's a sport management program. 90% of them are male. And I'm shocked when I start talking to them about barriers, about pipelines, about gender ideologies and those kind of things. Their response, this is the next generation coming through, are still, well, women's sport's not so good and women don't run as fast as men, so why do I want to watch them run? And I'm like, oh gosh, I thought you were hope. I thought the next generation was going to get this. So I think whilst it's really important that we work with people who are already in the organisations at decision-making levels, we have to filter this message back, all the way back through. My two sons and my daughter play football at a local club here, and my daughter's experience at 7 is completely different from my son's experience. She's hit her first glass ceiling at 7 years old. That's where she's first experiencing it, in soccer, in football. That's the first time she's hit a barrier in her life, is through sport. So we have to filter this down and challenge this and find, I want to educate my sons at the same time as I'm educating my daughter about equality. Mm. And that's right. Why we can't wait until we get to them being grown-ups and they're already in a system that supports one of them more than the other. And then we say, oh, now you've had all this privilege and power, can you share it? We need to educate them back down right from, children playing sport, in schools, everywhere, so that becomes the new normal and not something we're trying to change again 20 years down the line.
Right. And I think that's the hard part with systems change, is that we need to change the top down, and we also need to start at the grassroots community level and change it from the ground up. And there's so much work to do. And I often get people, when I talk to them about this, they feel despair and frustration is, well, what can I do? There's so many problems. And I always implore them to pick some level, whether you're talking to decision makers or mid-managers or you're educating your own students or your own children, pick something. Everybody can do something to create change. And if everybody does, who cares about this, like us, not everybody does, if everybody does something, then we can chip away and be complementary in trying to change the system from the top down and the bottom up.
I think it was Tolstoy that said, everyone thinks about changing the world, but no one ever thinks about changing, well, he said himself, but themselves. And I think what you're saying then, Nicole, is right. And we always talk about here with the work that we do with organisations, it does feel a really big task and it's demotivating. And the way that organisations are funded and programmes and initiatives are funded, they're very short often. So you have to do something very quick, very easy, and very quick wins and outcomes and achievements need to be very quick. So you tend to do the easier stuff, you know, picking the low-hanging fruit. And this sort of work, it's uncomfortable and it's long, and this isn't going to change overnight. But like you're saying, Nicole, and we advocate the same message, is if you can pick a few battles, pick a few behaviours that you want to challenge. It might be around, how do you get coaches into your organisation? Let's have a look at some of the recruitment practices, or let's have a look at level one here and how are we supporting coaches? Just those few battles and picking those few behaviours, or, okay, what are problematic, what's particularly problematic in this organisation? Because they'll impact everybody. It won't just be women. They'll feel the most acute effects of it. But it'll affect everybody if, for example, you cannot work from home. I mean, at the moment, everyone's working from home. But things like that, if you have to be in a certain place, there's no flexibility, and that will penalise people with caring responsibilities, which tend to be women, for example. But those sorts of battles and behaviours, if you pick them, you can start to see the effects and the achievements from overcoming that, then that starts to build confidence and starts to change the culture in other ways.
I didn't just come up with this, but I was reminded by an idea that I've been noodling on for maybe a year and a half as I'm doing this type of work as well, is, and I'm going to throw this out here now, so maybe we can own it together, is what if we developed an allyship curriculum for that's tiered. So top male decision makers, males that are in, you know, sport federations, running UEFA, running national and international level sport organizations. We invite all of them together. So it's a safe space where we can talk about this, where we can enlist their peers to talk about, their male peers. And then you get them all together. So it's not just, I'm talking to US Swimming and you're talking to UEFA. It's like you bring them all together in one place and you educate them together. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think that's a brilliant idea. When are we doing it?
Okay. You heard it here first on Tucker Center Talks. It needs to happen.
What is that? The idea of the, I can't remember if I've read it, is that this image of the table, and you imagine that many social groups, in this case, different groups of women, and of course, there'll be some groups of women that are worse off than other groups, for example, black and minoritized ethnic women coaches. If you've been excluded from that table, those people around the table, it is not up to the people outside of that table to have a conversation about how to change who sat at the table. It is those who are at the table need to have that very uncomfortable conversation. And often what's driving those, the way that people grip hold of their seat at the table, is this fear. It's like, what am I going to lose out? You know, what am I going to lose by this? What does this mean for me? And so the way that we communicate these messages and how we bring people on this journey is absolutely important. But it is not up to the people that have not got a seat at the table to have that conversation about how to be at the table.
Absolutely. So let me pivot here. As we've been talking about allyship and systems change and enlisting male allies. And Donna, I did like your point earlier when you said that oftentimes women are not allies of women as well. That's maybe a separate podcast. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole right now, but we all hear that. And that is a reality. Women do have bias against other women. And that's unfortunate, but it's a reality. But let me pivot here quickly as we're sort of wrapping this up, is the work that the three of us have done together with our colleague Annelise Knoppers, who's a pioneering legend in gender scholarship and systems change for 30 plus years. The study that we did together, where we interviewed high performance women soccer coaches around the world about a year ago, around the time of the Women's World Cup, share with our listeners some of the top level findings, maybe three of the key findings out of this study. And then we'll talk about what does this mean and how can we use this to create systems change. So either one of you want to jump in and share like three key findings out of this study?
I'll start with one, and then Leanne can scribble down something I don't say to start with. I think for me, and this is very similar to the current UEFA project, one of the top level findings for me, again, is the value of women, their perceived expertise. A lot of the women coaches that we spoke to were world championship players, Olympic medalists, experts at playing football, pioneers in that part of the game. And yet when they made the step change to go from player to coach, they had to start again. But we don't see that in the men's side of sport. You know, you get ex-professional players who are just parachuted into being a manager of a national team. But these women were having to start again. Their expertise is not, it doesn't have capital to transfer over the same way as men's does. And I think that was, for me, one of the biggest findings that translates into other areas of sport. Leanne?
And that was one of mine. I've got three listed, and that carries on to me. The burden of representation that women carry in that, they're seen as that risk factor, and the lack of trust that is shown in them and what they can do was alarming. And that, because they are so minoritized, that increases their surveillance of them. And so you end up being representative for all women. You know, we were talking to high performing women, and they were not just about, oh, this person is a great coach, or she's not done that right. It was, so women can't coach then. But you don't hear that often with men. Like, oh, he didn't do, you know, he got sacked and he can't manage that club now because he didn't get the results. So all men can't coach. But that's what you hear often with women.
One of the key things that I found interesting out of interviewing these women and listening to the interviews that you all did was when we asked them about the barriers or the challenges that they faced, at least the women that I interviewed, they were very reluctant in ways to talk about the barriers and the challenges because they either didn't see their own privilege in the system that they had made it, or they're really resilient women that are just badass and they choose not to see anything as a barrier or challenge because they're just going to do it anyway and persevere. And that really struck me as something that I'm wondering if we could tease out a little bit more. Is it that they just didn't see it, or they choose not to see it and focus on it and just move forward? I don't know. That was really something that struck me out of these interviews.
Yeah, because a lot of our research with high performing women coaches, when you talk to them, it's like, well, I wanted to play the sport. So I was absolutely certain I was going to play the sport and no one was going to stop me. And that was, you know, that was from an early age. But often people will say to me, well, why do we need more women? And I said, well, why don't you want more women? Because they are resilient. They're self-aware, they're self-confident. And when people talk about women lacking confidence, it just doesn't fly with me, because the women that I speak to, they're more confident often than any other people I speak to, and they're reflective and they're articulate. So why would you not want people, because they've had to go through a more difficult journey, why would you not want them? Because their resilience is higher, their networks are, the way that they've made the relationships within their role as they've come through this more difficult journey, they understand what it means to make relationships. So why would you not want them as coaches?
Absolutely. Donna, what do you think about this?
It's interesting the way that you framed it, Nicole. It made me reflect on, yes, I think it's a strength, this resilience, this strength in the women. I think it's something that it's good to see. But as I'm listening to you wrap it up like that, I also feel a sadness that they, it's almost an expectation that that's what they would have to do, that they don't see it because it's just expected that it's going to be a really difficult journey and it's going to be uncomfortable and it's what I should expect. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a two-time Olympic medaling rower, top-level coach. She was talking about supporting the next generations of coaches, women coaches coming through to help them get that tough skin so that they can survive. And it just breaks my heart that that's how we're, I see where she's coming from and I understand it, but it breaks my heart that that is what we have to expect. You know, for women to experience that. Again, it comes back to the systems that this is the system that they're experiencing. And I want to change that. I admire the resilience and the strength in these women. And as Leanne said, I applaud that and I would recruit that time and time again. But I don't want that to have to be the default position.
Well, and the danger of that as well is if the women aren't resilient and confident, because I agree with you, Leanne, this narrative around women lack confidence and we have books and the confidence code and, you know, leaning in and trying to get women to be more confident. It's another way to blame the women for the lack of confidence and why they don't succeed instead of looking at the system. And I think it too makes me sad, Donna, that we again blame the women and these high performing women coaches that we all have talked to. They've made it. I mean, they're confident, they're resilient, they have coping strategies, but it has also taken its toll on them. So the cost of this, of succeeding in the system, there is a psychosocial, occupational health cost to that for these women that many men, not all men, just don't have to deal with. And I think that's where changing the system is important, because we want all people, women included, to thrive and survive and be happy and healthy, because then they're better coaches and better human beings. And that's sort of where I land.
I mean, everybody, we want to have resilient workforces, but we don't want people to feel resilient against homophobia or feeling discriminated or harassed. That's a whole different, that's intolerable, whatever workplace that you have. And I think often we're expecting, particularly in this case, women coaches to be overly resilient. And I think with the coaches that we've worked with sometimes, they then can't monitor themselves when it's too much. So we've come across coaches that are burning out or have burnt out or are putting too much. I've spoke to a coach who always stuck with me. You know, she was getting divorced, she'd lost her house, she was so determined to keep coaching and etc. And she was almost over resilient. I'm not a psychologist, but we're asking a lot of our coaches, and why should we?
Well, let's wrap this up. And I wish we could just keep talking. Maybe we'll have to do a part two here of this podcast with the two of you, because we have so much to talk about together. And I think that people who care about these issues would love to hear more from the work that you're doing and we're doing. So let me just ask you to leave, if you have one parting thought about what sports stakeholders could use and apply from the work you're doing, what would be that sort of soundbite, that imparting hope as we wrap this up? Donna, do you want to start us off?
Oh, it's a big question.
I know.
I have a phrase of live it, learn it, work it. So I want organizations to understand the lived experience of what it's like to work in your sport, be that a decision maker, a coach, an athlete. Understand the lived experience for the different people in the organizations, learn from that experience and work out a way to make it a better place, make it inclusive, make it diverse, make it a safe space.
Great. I love that. Simple. Leanne.
I would follow that up. That's what I've just written down. Often we're very quick to jump in to try and solve things. And we learned from our UEFA work that you can't throw a blanket over this and expect to catch all and all the problems and in other sports and other contexts. The first step for me is diagnose what's going on in your organization, what works well, because it's not all about change, it's about strengthening as well. What works well, what doesn't work so well, understanding that reality. What does it mean to be a coach in my organization? Where are the issues, and then where do we need to tackle or strengthen? But understand rather than jumping straight in.
Live it, work it, understand, listen, don't dive in, be patient. Systems change is a long game. It's a marathon. Mm-hmm. And for those of us that are doing this, we're in the middle of it. So those of you that care about this, I would invite you to join us in thinking about where in the system can you make change. Someone once told me you can't eat an elephant in one bite. And I don't know if I'd want to actually even try that, but I think this that analogy applies here to systems change. So thank you, Drs. Norman and Dahan, for joining us on Tucker Center Talks today.
Thanks, Nicole, for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Nicole. It's been a pleasure.
So I'd love to hear from you. So tweet me at Tucker Center or to me directly at Dr. Sports Psych. Check out our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on Facebook or Instagram. You can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wispsports.com. Look for the Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find many more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.